On this episode of Skeptico.
And these aren't Chris Angel, 6 inch off the ground, 1 foot leading the other one up. I mean, this is like...
The documents show that Joseph frequently levitated while he was saying mass, just hovering a couple of inches above the ground. Well, I think the most spectacular case that I came across was on a Christmas Eve when he dragged in a bunch of shepherds who had their drums and musical instruments, and he got them to make merry. And he got so carried away, he levitated halfway up to the peak of the tower of the church. So that may have been as much as 31 or 51 feet. I'm not sure exactly. It doesn't matter. It was high. And so it's interesting that the religious as well as the scientific orthodoxies are very reluctant to handle and confront phenomena that they don't understand and they cannot control.
We're uncomfortable with that as well. We like our own trains to run on time. We don't like to think that miracles happen, that the consensus reality that we share with everyone is really just another option in terms of how everything works.
Stay with us for Skeptico.
Welcome to Skeptico, where we explore controversial science with leading researchers, thinkers, and their critics. I'm your host, Alex Sakaris, and I don't think it's at all a radical or controversial statement to say that most of us have come to accept our fascination with the new, the novel, the most recent research, the most recent blog post, the newest technology. And as a result of that, I think many of us have a bias against that which is old, that which is historical. And I have to say that bias almost led me to skip over this book. Today's guest, Dr. Michael Grosso, originally contacted me about discussing his amazing book about St. Joseph of Cupertino, the levitating saint. And I thought, do we really want to hear about some Catholic saint from hundreds of years ago who some religious zealots thought could fly? Well, as it turns out, I did want to hear about it and needed to hear about it, despite my initial misgivings. I think it adds an important piece to answering that pressing "how can this be?" question. I hope you enjoy this interview with Dr. Michael Grosso. Today we welcome Dr. Michael Grosso to Skeptico. Dr. Grosso is an independent scholar with a long-time association with the Division of Perceptual Studies at the University of Virginia that you've heard us talk frequently about on this show. He's also, along with that association, one of the co-authors of the fantastic book you might have heard about, The Irreducible Mind. He's also authored several other fascinating books exploring many aspects of the science of human consciousness, including his latest that we're going to talk a lot about today, The Man Who Could Fly, St. Joseph of Cupertino and the Mystery of Levitation. Mike, welcome to Skeptico. Thanks so much for joining me.
My pleasure, Alex. I'm glad to be here.
So, you know, we just have to start right in because it's a great hook in the title. Tell us about St. Joseph of Cupertino, the flying saint, the patron saint of poor students. I mean, there's a million fantastic stories in this guy's life. Where do you want to start?
Well, he's also, by the way, the patron saint of aviators, but I've modified that a little to call him the patron saint of aviators of consciousness. But anyway, the story of Joseph. Well, he lived in the 17th century. That ought not to disturb anybody, because if the facts are as they are recorded, a fact is a fact forever. So it has nothing to do with the time span.
And let's just interject right there at the beginning, because you touched on a key point, right? We've been kind of molded into believing that these saints are to just be kind of quaint, but kind of stories that aren't to be taken seriously. You have the ability to read some of the original documents written in Italian. And I mean, this is 1600s. I mean, these people are keeping detailed records of this stuff. So do you want to speak maybe very briefly to that? That, I mean, this is real history. They're talking about real people. We can track this stuff down. This isn't like impossible to verify some of this stuff, right?
Absolutely. I mean, in fact, I mean, Joseph lives, his lifespan covers most of the 17th century, and that is the century of the scientific revolution. And one of the things that's very obvious in reading the biography, or all of the biographies, but particularly the one that I use, is the sense of the author, of the biographer, knowing that these phenomena are extraordinary and incredible, and he keeps repeating over and over again, it's only because these have been documented, they have been seen by eyewitnesses, they have sworn under, you know, according to their faith, what they have seen is correct. And moreover, these phenomena were taking place for the entire span of Joseph's career, getting stronger as time went on, as a matter of fact, contradicting the classic decline effect in parapsychology.
Right.
As he got older, even the day before he died, if not the actual day that he died, he levitated while he was lying flat out on a table and being operated on.
And these aren't Chris Angel, 6 inch off the ground, 1 foot, leading the other one up. I mean, this is like...
I'll comment quickly about the range and the movements. The documents show that Joseph frequently levitated while he was saying Mass, but often in a rather unspectacular fashion, just hovering a couple of inches above the ground. So from that level to accounts of him getting carried away in the middle of a procession or walking along with a friend of his in the garden, where he would rise up into the air. Well, I think the most spectacular case that I came across was on a Christmas Eve when he dragged in a bunch of shepherds who had their drums and musical instruments, and he got them to make merry. And he got so carried away, he levitated halfway up to the peak of the tower of the church. So that may have been as much as 31 or 51 feet. I'm not sure exactly. It doesn't matter. It was high. So the range of his flights, as it were, or hoverings, was quite varied.
And you just might want to sneak in there that it's not just levitation. I mean, he exhibits a wide range of extraordinary abilities that are some we would call straight out psi kind of stuff. Others we just have no name for, but telepathic, you know, this is a psychokinetic kind of thing. But I mean, there's a range of strange, unexplainable phenomena going on around this guy, right?
Just about everything. I mean, I have a special chapter where I focus in the book on the evidence for his levitations, because I know how important that is. But then I have a following chapter. I think I call it A Complement of Talents, where I describe more briefly all the other accounts of his various phenomena. And they include what they called penetrating the secrets of hearts, otherwise known as telepathy nowadays, clairvoyance, prophecy, healing. He was an amazing healer. And is it harder to analyze the validity of the healing stories because we don't have medical documents in any great profusion? But even there, I was deeply impressed. Not as impressed as in the case of levitation, because in order to testify to the reality of levitation, you don't have to be a rocket scientist or a physician.
Right.
Or you need a good eyes to see as something that's so strange and so bizarre that you cannot possibly be mistaken unless you're in a setup where people are trying to deceive you. But in ordinary circumstances, if someone goes off the ground, even 5 inches or 3 feet, or flies up on top of a tree and hovers there like a bird for 15 minutes, that's something is easy to report on. I saw it. End of story. And I swear that I saw it. Blah, blah, blah. This day, for how long? You know, 5 minutes, 3 minutes, a second, and so on. I think that's an important part of a distinction to make, whereas the healing miracles, or I use that word rhetorically, the accounts of unusual or inexplicable healings are much harder to assess, and I wouldn't be as confident that every case reported was a genuine unusual healing. But in the case of levitations, for over 35 years, 150 written reports, plus untold numbers of people who must have seen him but didn't write anything down because he was doing all of these things outdoors in relationship to, you know, masses, processions, and all the rest, that the public events related to the church. So that I find it very difficult to avoid the conclusion the guy actually did these things, and there's so much evidence. But yes, there's lots of other stuff that he did, and there's no question about that. He was an all-around psychic, and of course his mysticism was mind-blowing. He was, one writer calls him the greatest ecstatic of all time. Right. The ecstasy, of course, was the mental state, and it was the precondition for the levitations. Not to say that every time he got ecstatic, or every time that anybody gets ecstatic, they fly off the ground.
There's so much ground to cover here. There's so many launching off points. So one is, what are the preconditions for this extraordinary levitation? Or we just covered, firstly, what is the documented evidence we have for the physical fact that this is a real phenomenon that happened? Then we could go into, you know, the political and social meaning of what those kind of extraordinary mystical experiences mean, and how a society tries to integrate that in with who they are and what that means and all that. So right. There, and you cover all those very, very nicely in the book, but you know, one that I'd pick out is the first one that I'd like to talk about, because it, in a way, it adds further evidence to substantiating that this really happened, is this stuff that he's doing wasn't so popular with the church. I mean, he's a priest, and you'd think, on one hand, you'd think that, wow, you know, he's all about his religion, he's all about his belief, he's all about very, very Catholic, Jesus and Mary and all that stuff. And he's constantly, you know, you mentioned the psychic thing. I mean, people don't want to go near him, because if they've sinned or if they've done wrong, man, he just sees right through it and he really calls them to task. But I guess the point I'm making is the church doesn't necessarily get on board with this for reasons that we can explore. But on one hand, it's also evidence that there was something extraordinary going on here.
Well, absolutely. The church does is very cautious about accepting reports and claims, or even on-site observations of extraordinary phenomena, for one simple reason. They are aware that there's a possibility of cheating and a need to be noticed, and, you know, all those normal psychological motivations that might be rather lower order. But secondly, they are concerned with the fact that they want to know that these phenomena, which the church automatically accepts as potentially real, they want to be sure that they are coming from Joseph in his in terms of his spiritual dedication to the church, that there's no conflict and that there is no diabolic agency involved. There was a lot of, this is a period of time when there was all kinds of strange phenomena, and some of them occurred to people who were apparently possessed by some kind of dark psychological, or if you like, spiritual agency.
Well, this is at the height of the whole witch hunt phenomena, really, right?
Pretty much, very much so. During the first part of the 16th century, according to several historians, was a peak period for accounts of diabolical possession. And so you have the diabolically possessed on the one hand, you have the fakes out there, and then you have the genuine, exceedingly rare, genuine cases of great mystics who were manifestly extraordinary human beings. The church had to be sure, And it was a kind of slow process that never quite ended until he died. And all of the witnesses came forward and narrated about his wonderful heroic virtues, as well as his psychic and miraculous phenomena. So that it was a slow process. But in the end, and by the way, not unusual with Joseph. The church gets on its haunches and gets paranoid immediately. Not so much paranoid, careful. Very careful whenever an individual is highly charismatic. And for one thing, they're afraid if someone is that charismatic, they could break off from the church and start their own movements.
Exactly. And that's what I was going to say. I mean, well, that's a nice way to characterize it in terms of careful. A more kind of Machiavellian view of it is that the church is really not about the spiritual, and especially these transcendent kind of experiences that don't really fit with what they want to do. They want to control and manage and kind of move their enterprise forward on one track. And on another track, of course, it's spiritual. But I mean, right. As you explore in the book and on some of your excellent blog posts that we might have a chance to talk about, there is a heavy political, societal kind of Mussolini keep the trains running on time aspect to both the church and modern scientific culture that has always had play in these things, right?
Absolutely. You know, it's actually in current times more problematic for the miracle worker in the 20th century than it was in the 17th century. And the example I would give would be the case of Padre Pio. Padre Pio is a kind of parallel, somewhat parallel, but not quite as extraordinary as St. Joseph. But Padre Pio, as listeners may know, was a 20th century mystic with the stigmata for 50 years. And he, too, was famous for out-of-body experiences, projecting himself all over the place, wonderful, amazing stories, healings, and everything. But he ran into much more active resistance on the part of the church. Members within the church itself attacked him as being a phony and all of that. And the reason is, quite simply, that we are living in a more, more intensely established age of science. And the fear of miracles, of phony miracles, is the last thing that the church wants to deal with. And so Padre Pio had a really hard time getting accepted as a genuinely holy man because of his phenomena in a way that was probably more resistant than the church was to St. Joseph in the 17th century. But yes, there's that political dimension which is absolutely crucial. And both then and now. And so it's interesting that the religious as well as the scientific orthodoxies are very reluctant to handle and confront phenomena that they don't understand and they cannot control.
And there's a practical reason for that, too, because it's a complete reflection of us, of who we are. We're uncomfortable with that as well. We like our own trains to run on time. We don't like to think that miracles happen, that the consensus reality that we share with everyone is really just another option in terms of how everything works, right?
I agree that there is. I would say something like this. I would say the more educated a person is, the more likely he or she will be hesitant and reluctant to embrace something so strange and fantastic as levitation. Whereas ordinary, less educated people who are more receptive, let's say, to the entertainment and wondrous value of some of these stories, and less rigidly mentally constructed as individuals, are apt to be a little bit more responsive. And then there are folks like us who are open-minded. I think we can say that about ourselves, Alex, can we? and we are open to the facts of human experience. And if these things are real, we want to know. and let our science and let our religious orthodoxies adapt to the facts of human experience. That's the view that I promote. And I also think that these facts are not just bare facts. They are facts with enormous implications for our understanding of what it is to be a human being. And but you're absolutely right. It's a battle today as it was then.
I think you're quite right to say that the facts are important. And when they do bump up against our cherished, closely held beliefs that we don't want to let go of, I mean, that's kind of a good thing, isn't it? And that's what you've done in a historical sense in this book by saying, hey, look, there's this huge body of historical records, not just of St. Joseph, but of many other people, that completely contradicts this worldview that we're holding on to so tightly. And then I think for a lot of people, what it does is it reminds them of other times they've encountered similar cases in their own personal experience that they've kind of swept under the rug because they didn't want to deal with. I love the story that you give in the book about when you were a professor in New York and your experience with and experiment with quasi-levitation. Do you want to tell people a little bit about that? Because I think it's a great story.
Absolutely. I was team teaching a course. Actually, it was at the City University of New Jersey back in the 80s, I think, 90s perhaps. And it was a course on personality development. And we were studying, you know, shamanism, mysticism, all those phenomena that and all those practices that promise to raise and evolve our consciousness. So one day, one of the young ladies in the class told about an experiment, a game that she used to play with girls at slumber parties called Light as a Feather. I think that was the name of it. And what it involved was really an experiment in levitation, in which they would kind of, they'd be four people who would just touch the bodies of the fifth person, the person to be lifted, and they would chant together or sing together, speak together, and then say lift. And very often it happened that the child would lift. So I thought in this class would be fun to try this in our class because we had been doing things together like meditating and chanting. So we picked out a very large ex-Marine, must have weighed about 200 pounds, and then I took four of the frailest young women and had two of them put two fingers from the hands facing down underneath his legs and the other two ladies underneath his elbows. And we did the routine. And it took about, you know, maybe a minute of chanting and breathing together. I had no idea what was going to happen. And then I finally said, lift. And then it happened. The entire class was completely astonished, so was I, and most of all was that ex-Marine. He up into the air he went, and I could see they were not straining, stressing. They were just touching him. It was exactly like when you touch a Ouija board, then in playing around with the Ouija board. Most of us who have done this know the damn thing moves without us pushing it.
Right,
it was
right.
The same process, except that this time not a little light, you know, pointer, but a 200-pound man who was sitting, you know, in a chair, who went up in the air, and it was really quite an astonishing thing. That was in the back of my mind for a long time. And when I got this book on St. Joseph's, the biography of Joseph, I picked it up when I was traveling in Italy. That was the point where I decided one day I'm going to translate this book and write a book about this guy because it's really far out. So, that was that experience. And it goes on today. Since I published the book, many people have came to me and say, you know, I did that when I was a kid. And I want to emphasize that. In fact, I want to write a piece about this to show that in children's games that are widespread, that people, you know, enjoy all over the world, it may be that things are happening that really baffle science. Because if you start raising people up into the air just by touching them and doing some other psychic rigmarole, you've got a challenge. Of course, you know, no one is observing these kids. It's not scientific evidence. But nonetheless, it's an interesting thing to realize that it may be much more common than we suppose.
Don't we have to be careful when we say scientific evidence? Because as you do a marvelous job of pointing out in the book, I mean, where you go in the book is to say, okay, here's what happened with this extraordinary human being. And if we're really open to this case, then we have to be open to many, many, many other cases. What I thought immediately in the book is reading the autobiography of a yogi about the Yogananda, whose ashram is, you know, 5 miles from my house. And in the first 30 pages of that book, there's similar accounts of, you know, bilocation, levitation, raising of the dead, and all this stuff. So if we, what you've done is document one account rather thoroughly and resurrect it, if you will, from the annals of history, but it forces us to look for a number of accounts. But I digress, because what you've really done in the book is then say, what does this mean? What can, would this possibly mean for science, who has diligently made a great effort to exclude and demean all these kind of accounts and completely look the other way? But also, what does it, what possible explanations could we have for this? So let's shift gears a little bit and talk about, what does this mean? If we accept that this stuff really does happen, what does this mean about who we are? And what does this mean in terms of how science relates to it?
Well, that's, of course, a big question. I'll try to answer with a few thoughts. The first thing that I derive from the confrontation of this evidence is the realization that we have to deepen our understanding of the mind, because, as I pointed out, the levitations, which involve an apparent, you know, impact on the law of gravity, they only took place when Joseph was in a special state of mind. And so the problem, the challenge then of levitation is, how can a special state of mind, we happen to call it ecstasy, and we can describe that state in great detail, both the physiology and the psychology of it, but how is it possible for that state of mind to influence and temporarily modify impact upon one of the four basic forces of the universe? That now is a challenge, and of course the subtitle of my book is The Mystery, so I don't have, you know, the answer, but I do have some suggestions. But part of the explanation has to be psychological, and that is a challenge. What is going on? How are our minds capable of doing these things in the first place? The standard reductive view of the human mind as a mere reflex, as it were, at best, of the human brain, simply is not going to account for a phenomena that indicate the power of the mind to impact, to shape gravity itself. So that's the problem then is, how do we enlarge our concept of mind? And secondly, then there's the impact on physics. There has to be a physical explanation of levitation if it occurs. And so the challenge is twofold. On the one hand, to psychology and the nature of mind, and on the other hand, to physics. And I would add a third major challenge. I'm talking about major challenges. And that is this, my approach at any rate, to the so-called miracles and extraordinary phenomena of the saints and other, and shamans and yogis and the whole realm. My approach, I think, suggests that we need to rethink and reinterpret many of the phenomena, reports, and narratives that we associate with religion. Now, I want to be clear. I'm not suggesting, as a result of my research, that we have to go back and accept Orthodox religion as true simply because some of the claims of miracles, so-called miracles, are true. I'm not saying that at all. I'm saying that we have to revise our attempts to understand these religious behaviors and try to combine our understanding of them with science, with art, with human psychology, and see where that leads us. And generally, my...
But let's talk about where that leads us, because it's complicated in a couple of ways. I mean, first, I like what you said about, and it's obvious to listeners of Skeptico and to you and me, but that we need to get past this materialistic, reductionistic, mind equals brain kind of stuff, because it just doesn't fit the data. No matter what else you want to say about it, we're just amassing all this data that it just has to keep pushing away because it can't possibly fit it in its paradigm. So we can't even stumble forward if we don't get past that big mountain. And I see that as, you know, in your book, you talk about Henry Bergson, you know, and him speculating, what if we spent 400 years on a model that said, hey, the mind really does have all these extraordinary abilities. Where would we be if we really concentrated on the science of telepathy, the science of psychokinesis and all the rest? And I'm totally with you. And we contrast that with, you know, the mode we've been in, the misquoted but aptly attributed in some ways, Richard Feynman, shut up and calculate kind of thing. You know, it's like, okay, let's take quantum physics, shut up, calculate, get our iPhone, get your GPS, get all that, which we can all relate to too, and it's had its benefits. But your point is, what if we went the other direction? You know, we could all walk around and have amazing abilities. But on this other point, I think we're also similarly stuck with religion, you know, and we're saying, oh, well, let's not get too close to that because we know how crazy and cultish that has been, and we can trace back all the horrible things that it's done. But are we missing, are we stepping over the spiritual? And is the spiritual at the core of this, at the center of this, in a way that we don't understand, but in a way that mystics and wisdom traditions have pointed to all along? And, you know, to introduce the G word, it's like, hey, guys, if you don't start with God, if you don't start with the hierarchical nature of this extended consciousness, you're kind of playing the wrong game anyway. Do you have any thoughts on that, that if we jump over to the religion thing, even if we leave behind the orthodoxy, we are faced with some spiritual questions that are much, much bigger than we're comfortable with?
Well, that's a great phrasing and question that you've posed. And I'll say one or two things. First of all, I would say this, that all the great religions are evolving. And even the Dalai Lama says very consciously nowadays, we have to look at science and we may have to modify our views and interpretations of religion. So I think that the challenge is to allow the religious perspective to gradually blend more and more with science. And where it doesn't blend adequately, it has to just adapt and move on and renounce many of the old dogmas. For example, the dogma of that, let's say, Catholicism would say the miracles from other religions may not be valid or something like that. Or the Muslims might say something like that because they believe their view is the sole access to truth. I think that is a complete mistake. And what we're, I think that the study of these phenomena point toward the evolution of a more like a world religion. And I think that at the core of this world religion, from my point of view, is not anything theological, but something that we can simply describe as consciousness. It took me a while, Alex, in my own research, to come to a point where I came to see consciousness as not only fundamental to our very sense of reality, but then this was the big move for me, at any rate. I came to see consciousness as independent of the brain. we use our brains. Our brains and the world of consciousness are interwoven together, but they're separate. And my view is that the pure consciousness or the pure spirit that is glimpsed by many of the great mystics, whether they be Catholic mystics or Buddhists or Sufis or diviners from pagan traditions, I think that they're all tuning in to this one great fundamental mystery, which is the mystery of consciousness. It is a mystery because we can't explain how it is produced by the brain. That's a great problem. But let's assume that there is this one great consciousness, and human beings evolving in different cultures, different times, have caught glimpses and of that, let's say, we'll call it, if you like to use the language of religion, the kind of divine splendor. They've caught it, they've been transformed by it, and they interpret it using their own language based on their own culture. If they're Jewish prophets, they tune into it from a prophetic perspective. If they're yogis, all the experiences are molded in accordance with the conceptual apparatus of yoga. If they're Catholics, Muslims, whatever. So my view is that we're coming to the point in the 21st century when we're beginning to see the fundamental core of all our philosophies and all our religions to be this mystery which we're all privy to. Every waking person is confronting a mystery, the mystery of their own consciousness. That consciousness is part of a greater consciousness. And I believe that all the great religions and philosophies and the great artists have tuned in, had revelations, gained insights into that core reality. And the great civilizations of the world are, in a sense, reflections of those experiences. And anyway, that is my quick take on how I would view this process. And I think we're at a very interesting point where more and more scientists are coming to see the autonomy consciousness as a reality.
I think that's a great way to put it. But at the same time, you know, I like the quote that you have in your book and the references you make to Whitehead and about the transcendent nature of religion at its really spiritual core. And it always makes me wonder if a lot of the speculation we do along the lines that you're talking about aren't from the other side of the equation, if you will. You know, one of the great truths that come out of the near-death experience research, and I say truth, I guess I ought to put that in quote, is over and over again, people come back and say, you're living the dream. The reality is over there. You're living the dream over here. And I mean, if we take that at anything close to a true statement, then all that stuff we're talking about, you were just talking about, needs to be flipped on its head. You know, we're constantly misinterpreting everything because we're on the wrong side of the equation. And I think that's what Whitehead's alluding to in this transcendence. I mean, we are seeing truth through the spiritual. I mean, this is what I think they're saying, is that you're seeing truth in the transcendent, but you can't really bring that truth back because you're now on the other side of the equation.
I think it's true to say that most of us are, and here is a point that Bergson made, most of us are preoccupied, trapped, as it were, forced to adapt to our biological survival on a fractious planet, becoming more and more fractious and challenging. And our brains, in a certain sense, in a very definite sense, are designed to enable us to adapt to the everyday non-transcendent world of the struggle for existence, to use Darwin's terminology, or he may not have even used that term. So it's only in unusual, exceptional circumstances where the connection to the everyday world breaks down, as in a near-death experience, or in a moment of inspiration, or during a tragic loss, or anything that breaks the connection with everyday reality. It is those experiences that open us up to the transcendent potential. And so ordinary life is, as you say, taking place on the other side of transcendence most of the time. And that's just a fact of reality that we have to face. But those of us who become, who wake up for one reason or another to that other world and those greater possibilities, well, maybe we're a little more lucky, and we also acquire as a result of that good fortune an obligation to spread the word and try to point in that direction to other people who are sadly caught up in and trapped in the low orders of everyday consciousness.
Oh, that's awesome, and that's certainly what you're doing in this book. And you're also doing on your blog. Let's talk a little bit about your blog and how people can find out more about what you're up to. You've written many other great books. Maybe you just want to touch on a couple others that might be of interest to people and where they can find your blog.
Well, I did write a book called Experiencing the Next World Now, which reviews all the different kinds of evidence for life after death. But what it tries to do is overcome that gap that we just spoke about, of being trapped in the lower level, as it were, of our biological. So that book, I attempt to show that there are different ways that we don't have to wait to be visited by a ghost or have a near-death experience or see an apparition before we may, you know, be lucky enough to catch a glimpse of our deeper selves, which is immersed in a world that may very well be independent of our physical existence. So I talk about meditation, about fasting, about opening ourselves up to experiences that will give us glimpses, perhaps, of this deeper reality. And one of the points I try to make, and I touch on this in some of my posts on my blog, is that the mystery is not that far away from us, that there are ordinary things in ordinary everyday life that many of us may be experiencing that give us these rare glimpses into the transcendent world. One of them, for example, is music. I recently wrote a post on music and the sense of immortality. And it was prompted by a report on the radio about a great a book that's been written about the music of Bach. And the author described how all of the people who play Bach, whether they are atheists or not, or materialists or not, while they're performing the great music of Bach, they feel as though they're in touch with a transcendent world, with a divine world, with God, with, you know, the heavenly realms or whatever. And that brought back to mind some experiences that I had when I was very young and listening to the first time to medieval music and French music, particularly Debussy, who's always turned me on. And I remembered experiences, Alex, that I had when I was quite young, listening to music, and it made me think about, I kind of lost all fear of death. Not that I was thinking about death at the time, but somehow it made me want, strange as it is going to sound, very bizarre, but I wanted to die. I wanted to go into that world, the world that I was getting a sense of listening to this music. Had this very curious reaction on me. So I think that that particular book, tries to suggest that the other world may be a whole lot nearer than we think. And all it takes is a change of consciousness. So one of the things we need to learn to do to get a little closer to the core of our transcendent potential is to really be a little more introspective, to pay a little more attention to our inner life from moment to moment, how we're feeling, how we're sensing things, how we react to a beautiful sunset, how people make us feel about the deeper potentials of our realities. So a lot of the attentiveness to our own inner states may very well point to or reveal to us things that we hadn't suspected existed before. So anyway, that's a topic of one of my books and a theme that I'm trying to explore in various ways on my blog. And the central idea of the blog is that we don't know the limits or the outer limits of consciousness, and we don't know the origins of consciousness. That's a fact. It may sound strange, but it is true. So each of us is a walking mystery. Each of us has right in front of us a doorway that we can step through if the circumstances are right. And if we're alert to the possibilities, and if we're courageous enough to try, God knows what will happen if we shift the orientation of our consciousness more inwardly. Those are some thoughts on that subject.
Well, that's awesome. Who knows? We all might be able to fly like St. Joseph did. So again, the book is The Man Who Could Fly, St. Joseph of Cupertino and the Mystery of Levitation. You can also find Mike's blog at consciousnessunbound.net. I'll have a link to that in the show notes as well as to the book. Fascinating. We've barely only scratched the surface, touched on both the book and the larger body of thought and great ideas that have gone into this guy's work, so you really need to check this out. Mike, thanks again so much for joining me today on Skeptico.
Well, thanks you. Thank you, Alex. It was a pleasure.
Thanks again to Dr. Michael Grosso for joining me today on Skeptico. I guess I'd tee up one question from this interview. Why do we shy away from these historical accounts? And Mike actually adds an interesting twist to that question. And that is, why do we seem to shy away from present-day accounts of this nature even more vigorously? I think we touched on a couple of potential answers, but I'd like to hear your thoughts on that. Of course, the place to do it is through the Skeptico website at skeptiko.com. You can join a discussion on the forum or send me an email, reach me on Facebook, or just add a comment right there to the show. Many ways to do it. The important thing is that I really hope you connect with me and with other people who enjoy this show and enjoy this perspective. As you know, there are a variety of different opinions in these areas we talk about. And of course, everything isn't resolved just because we get past the ridiculous materialism that dominates science. So one thing I always hope for Skeptico to do was to stimulate real discussion, a real hard-nosed examining of some of these complex issues that lie beyond this goofy materialism. So if you agree with that, then I hope you find a place here at Skeptico to share some of those thoughts. Of course, while you're there, you can share any show that you see. It's a great way to tell other people about the show. It's the primary way we have of getting the word out about Skeptico. So do share. You can also write a review or just write an email and tell somebody about the show as well. All those methods work. So I have a couple of interesting shows coming up. I have a really good one next week that I'm really excited to bring you. It's my interview with noted mainstream scientist, atheist, materialist, Dr. Sean Carroll, who has a new book. And like I say, I think you'll enjoy that. I enjoyed doing that one. So that's coming up. And then I have some other really good ones in the hopper after that as well. So I do hope you stay with me for all of that. Until next time, take care and bye for now.